Good afternoon, everyone, and thank you for joining us for February's Emergency Club webinar. I'm very pleased to introduce you to our speaker for today, European and RCVS recognised specialist in veterinary soft tissue surgery, Catherine Sturgeon. Thank you, Catherine. I'm now going to hand over to you.
Lovely. Thank you, Emma, and welcome everybody who's tuning in this afternoon to the Emergency Webinar Club. I thought today we would have a chat about the sort of stomach lurching sensation that we will all have had from time to time when we've encountered unexpected surgical bleeding, and I thought it was a good subject really to discuss on why, you know, if we, how we can perhaps preempt, is there likely to be bleeding that will occur, and if so, how can we better prevent against that bleeding, but equally, if we still have a surgical bleeder, what then can we do about it? How can we put those skills into action so that hopefully, even if we do get bleeding, we can approach the situation in a calm and effective manner. So the actual concept of surgical wanting to stop bleeding has been around for a long time, and certainly way back in, if you think about the Roman era and the gladiators, they were very good at applying, for instance, a good old-fashioned tourniquet, and they realised that if we elevated that bleeding limb, that the flow would slow. Equally, in the ancient Egyptian times as well, there are definite indications that they would have used heat as also a form, a way of stopping bleeding. So in our modern day hemostasis, how are we going to control, how have we moved on with our techniques that we can use? And so if we think about a skilled surgical performance, absolutely thinking about the good old Halstead's principles still hold very strong today. And the more prepared you are, the more you've planned to do something, you've thought about what you're going to need before, after a surgery, and then your actual technical ability to handle things very gently, and obviously part of that principle of surgery absolutely is accurate and meticulous hemostasis. If we, when we're performing surgery, we know that if we're going to get a bleeder, that blood, then we get the platelet plug formation, that will then activate a cascade of coagulation, and then we get a more of a mature clot forming. And the aims really of being, you know, a good surgeon and a careful surgeon, if we get good hemostasis, it means we've got a dry surgical field, so therefore we can actually see what we're doing, we can be accurate with the surgery, we're then far less likely to damage the surrounding structures, and clearly that's more enjoyable because we can actually see what we're doing, and surgery does become more enjoyable if we're trying to access things through a poor exposure and everything is oozing. It's not very enjoyable for our patients, and that's got to be the main reason we're wanting to improve our skills. Their tissue healing is going to be improved, they're going to have less contusion and bruising, they're going to feel better post-operatively, and equally, not only is their morbidity lowered, but their infection risk is also lowered because the tissues are less traumatised and we've got less blood, blood clots hanging around, waiting for potentially to act as a nidus for the bacteria to live on and live within. So I thought what we'd do today in our webinar plan is obviously we're just really focusing in on the surgical patient, and I felt that we could perhaps look at how to spot that high-risk patient walking in through the consulting room door. So before we've even got our scalpel blades out, which ones might be a problem, and then we can look at the support that we've got both prior to the operation and during the operation. What can we use to help ourselves get a more accurate meticulous hemostasis? We'll also look at some equipment so that we are again prepared, and that very much is a word that keeps being mentioned, but the more prepared we are for any eventuality, and this includes emergency surgery as well, if you're prepared with your equipment, you're familiar with it, then accessing a bleeding situation and ligating the bleeders that we've got will be easier to do. And ultimately, if we've still got a bleeder, you know, what are our options? So those are the sort of categories that I thought we could chat through today. So first things first, and I'm not going to spend too long on this because I know a lot of the textbooks are going to be able to cover the ins and outs of hemostasis and fibrinolysis far better than and in far more detail than I could ever do. But we've got a vascular injury, and as we've said a few minutes ago, when you've got a vascular injury, the first thing that's going to happen is that the platelets are going to form a platelet plug, and that very much is our primary hemostasis. The secondary hemostasis is when our coagulation cascade happens, and the coagulation cascade is going to act to provide more fibrin polymers, which then stabilize that platelet plug, and then we get our mature thrombus. So those primary and secondary hemostasis progressions, they occur not separately, very much there's a huge overlap, and then we've got our mature thrombus. So great, we've got our mature clot, and then eventually the process of fibrinolysis starts to dissolve the fibrin clot. But even before we've gone surgically, obviously there could be conditions that may affect the actual primary hemostasis. So we may have, for instance, a condition where our patient's got decreased production of platelets. So if we've got a patient with thrombocytopenia, if they've got, for instance, an estrogen-secreting tumour, or we may have a situation where our platelets are being destroyed, so patients with immune-mediated thrombocytopenia. There's a huge list of different possibilities within our differentials, but these are just examples. Or equally, if we've got a septic patient, it might be that a lot of our platelets have been used up. If we have a patient that is taking medications, those medications could also affect the way our platelets are able to function. For instance, on non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs, it's possible. And equally, inherited conditions like our von Willebrand's disease patients, that absolutely will affect platelet function. Equally, for secondary hemostasis, so this is our coagulation cascade, if we've got patients that are in shock, have a vitamin K deficiency, for instance, or have an inherited disorder like a haemophilia, again, the secondary hemostasis will be affected. So before our patients have, you know, we've got as, not got as far as going into theatre, absolutely the ability to, as always, take a good history is absolutely vital. So when should alarm bells ring? So history taking and clinical examination are absolutely vital. And although, you know, there are certain breeds, which I'm sure we're all familiar with, you know, our Doberman being the classic, perhaps one that's the breed most affected with our von Willebrand's factor type 1, and our GSD perhaps with our haemophilia, there are, for instance, you know, 30 breeds that technically have been documented as having a deficiency in von Willebrand's factors. So we mustn't become transfixated with a certain breed, but little alarm bells should ring if certain breeds walk through the door. Equally, looking again at more patient factors, again, when should we think, well, hang on a minute, let's just maybe do some more tests before we rush straight into theatre. So patients, again, these are just examples, but patients with extrahepatic tract biliary obstruction, the bile is very important in the way vitamin K is absorbed, and obviously vitamin K is very important for activation of some of our coagulation factors. So those patients, alarm bells should ring. Do we need to do some screening tests? And equally, patients with a hepatopathy may well have, deficiencies in some coagulation factors. Certain patients with certain conditions, so looking at our procedure factors really, and again this list is not exhausted. There are lots of conditions whereby we may preempt that bleeding is or could be a problem. So certainly patients with thyroid masses, they are incredibly vascular, and for those that have even try to biopsy a thyroid tumor, you will be met by a huge surge of bleeding out of the biopsy site. So if you do get a dog or a cat for that matter with a thyroid mass or a mass within the thyroid region, it's probably best to not biopsy those masses. I would just FNA those masses, and if you get a result on your FNA, great. If you don't get a result of thyroid carcinoma on your FNA, the next stage in this situation is probably not go for an incisional biopsy, but perhaps plan a more of a definitive surgery where the tumour is just going to be lifted out en bloc, with correct hemostasis being used. It's a far more controlled situation in that way. Equally, adrenal gland tumours are very renowned for being very vascular. Hemangiosarcomas, obviously by their very nature, they are derived from blood vessels. And certainly, if you were to see a patient presenting with, this is a boxer, and this is the his dorsal aspect here, and you can see that he's lost his outline. He's got a very large swelling. Alarm bells should ring. Whilst this could be a huge lipoma, this could be subcutaneous hemangiosarcoma, and I can guarantee for those patients it's literally like a honeycomb of blood. So again, you're quite, FNAs are a brilliant thing to do, so popping a needle in is good, and if you literally aspirate and you fill up a syringe of blood, alarm bells should be ringing. That's probably a patient with subcutaneous hemangiosarcoma. You definitely don't want to biopsy that, and obviously sadly the prognosis is not good. You definitely don't want to be taking that to surgery and trying to excise it. Mammary tumours, as we know, can be very vascular, and there are many types of neoplasia. So this list is not exhaustive by any means, that neovascularization is a major component of those cancers, which then cause the surgeon a lot of distress if we are not prepared on how we're going to actually deal with those blood vessels at the time of surgery. Other procedure factors, masses that are under hormonal influence, can cause a lot of bleeding. And this is one that we see from time to time. I put this image up. This was a Springer Spaniel, and this is her vulval end here, and this is a large protruding vulval mass. If we were to perform an episiotomy in order to remove this mass, that might just not be as straightforward as we think, even if we've got the urethra catheterized. These masses, even if they themselves don't look very vascularized, the whole of the lining of the vagina will just ooze and ooze because the dog is so greatly influenced hormonally, and perhaps in those situations it's much better to perform an ovariohysterectomy as the first stage, and then give the patient quite a few weeks and months, and gradually you'll probably find in the majority of cases this will all shrink away and will not need surgical attention. So we've looked at our patient factors, we've looked at our procedure factors, so we're trying to weigh up with our patients, are they likely to, have they got the potential to bleed? We're looking at our procedures, and has that operative procedure got the potential to cause bleeding? And if we're getting a few alarm bells ringing, then there's no, you know, there's no reason why we shouldn't do a few screening tests. So these are screening tests to look at our platelet count, and a very good way at looking at the ability of our patients to clot. So the buccal mucosal bleeding time is looking at the primary hemostasis, and we can see here this is a Springer Spaniel. He's having a buccal mucosal bleeding test performed, so he's got a little bit of a gauze bandage, which is just holding his lip up. We've made a very small nick in the mucosa, and there are some nice little gadgets that will just do this directly for you. It's a very superficial little cut that's made. And then with a piece of blotting paper, we're just going to time how long it takes for the clot to form, and the blotting paper must not disrupt the clot. And then for normal patients, dogs and cats, we should have, dogs should be roughly less than 4 minutes and cats less than 2 minutes. Looking at our secondary hemostasis, we've got prothrombin time and activated partial thromboplastin time, and again, worth running. There are some nice little handheld gadgets that you can get where this test can now be done instantaneously within the practice. They don't have to be sent away necessarily, so you get some nice immediate results from those handheld devices. And again, if we're getting values of the PT or of the APTT that are 1.5 times the control, then again, alarm bells should be ringing that perhaps our patients are going to be potentially more likely to have a bleeding event during surgery, and therefore we need to think about that and plan for that, or perhaps consider, is surgery actually something we want to do or not. I mentioned TEG. TEG is thromboelastography, and something that is the most ideal way, I guess, of looking at how that, well, the entire clotting profile, really. So from the minute we get coagulation to how the clot forms and how stable the clot is. So it's a whole sort of global evaluation of your clotting ability. TEG is something that we don't have very it's not very available in many centres. We have it available in some of our university and referral settings, but it's not yet something that we have available in for a practice situation. But TEG is something, I'm sure, as the years go on, that will come, will be more and more available to us, we hope. So blood products, obviously, for our patients whereby we've highlighted that there could be a major problem, or that the surgical event itself, so such as, for instance, an adrenalectomy, we would want to perhaps have these blood products or some blood products available should there be a problem intraoperatively. We are very fortunate nowadays to have the PET blood bank at our disposal for use within our profession. When that wasn't available many years ago, all we could do was rely on our donor, our patients that are, you know, that we had on our list from our practices. And don't get me wrong, they're still a very valuable source of fresh whole blood, but the PET blood bank not only can supply our different blood products, but also their website is incredibly useful when you're thinking ahead and trying to work out what it is you need, which blood products are going to be most helpful for different situations. So do take a look at the PET Blood Bank's website. It's a very, very useful tool indeed day to day. I thought I'd just mention briefly our Dobermans and von Willebrand disease, the dogs that have a type 1 von Willebrand's. Certainly if we feel that we're going to need to do surgery on our Dobermans, so for instance, if we are going to neuter them, then it's worth considering running the screening test. And if we have a patient whereby they're diagnosed with a problem, again, always just take a few steps backwards, reconsider what it is you're actually planning to do surgically. Is it 100% necessary, or is it very, very elective? Sometimes the decision to not perform surgery is the correct thing to do, but if you are going to perform surgery, consider maybe using DDAVP. DDAVP will stimulate the release of Willebrand's factor, which then enables your platelets to form a better adherence to the endothelium, so therefore a better platelet plug. It can be administered subcutaneously or intranasally, and it onsets within 30 minutes and it lasts for a couple of hours. Equally, the use of fresh frozen plasma or a more superior blood product to the cryoprecipitate will also be of benefit to use in these patients if necessary. So just again, a little bit of thought before we actually start any surgery. So being prepared means a number of things with surgery. And I think if you get into the habit that this list in front of you should be very much part of your normal day, then it means that if you do get an intraoperative bleed, then you're far more equipped to deal with it because you are very well set up to start with. You've got a good planned surgical exposure, so we're not operating through a little tiny linear incision. You can see what you're doing, and certainly if you've started off with a small incision and you cannot see what you're doing and you're getting a bleeding problem, then you make that incision bigger and you reset yourself back up again so that you can see what you're doing in order to perform your surgery and hemostasis more accurately. So lighting is key, and I think nowadays, certainly I operate in a lot of practices, and the lighting is getting better and better wherever I go. So I think nowadays we have better equipped theatres. The LED lights are so much better than the old-fashioned surgical lights we used to have, and they're becoming much more available, much more doable financially for everybody to have. Draping, you know, drape big, don't be using small drapes, you know, particularly if you're going to be doing, bitch bay procedures. These are major procedures abdominally, so drape accordingly. Do use retractors, and this can be self-retaining retractors or a human hand, you know, scrubbed in is worth its weight in gold. More and more practices are getting diathermy units, and we'll talk about those shortly. I think it should be an integral part of every theatre. It's very useful for reasons we will come on to shortly, but again, it should be part of the normal equipment. Surgical suction, again, as we can see here, this unit is a small unit. This is what I use for everything, and it cost less than £100. So these are not expensive pieces of equipment to use, but very useful if suddenly you've got surgical bleeding. Swabs, that goes without saying, have normal size swabs and also laparotomy swabs. You need some fine mosquito hemostats and some surgical clips. And again, the surgical clips we'll come to during the webinar today. So if we are planning to do something, again, just thinking ahead, we need to protect the airway. If we're going to do something in the mouth, or for instance, if we're going to do airway surgery, we need to, or dentistry, we need to prevent blood going backwards. So we need to carefully inflate the cuff on the ET tube, and we need to pack the oral cavity. So these are preemptively thinking, okay, we're going to get blood in the oral cavity, there's no question about that during this procedure. What can we do to prevent it going down the airway or around the back of the nose, which again is going to compromise our patient if that happens. So let's look at different ways. We've hopefully preempted which patients could be problematic, may have that potential to bleed. We've organised ourselves with our equipment. We've got in blood products if indeed we think that that's going to be necessary. We're now in surgery. So how can we, first of all, reduce the blood flow or stop the blood flow? So The use of pressure, digital pressure, is a very common sense approach and very valuable. So it takes about 30 seconds for a clot to start forming, and it takes 2 to 3 minutes for a clot to stabilize. So getting your swabs and pressing might be a complete resolution, or it might be a temporary resolution if we indeed, it depends very much on the size of the vessel that's bleeding, the diameter of the vessel, how much blood pressure we've got going on, what the patient's coagulability is to form that clot. Also, if the patient's a bit cold, or if we've got hypothermia, which I know a lot of patients do go quite cool during surgery, they may clot quite quickly. Obviously, the converse of that is when the patient's warming up again post-surgery, that's when sometimes the hemostasis is not as good as we thought it was. But the use of pressure, common sense, very useful in view of providing either a permanent or temporary hemostasis. If we have, with some patients, a massive abdominal bleed, and this might pertain more to situations where we have trauma patients, so surgery might not have actually been performed, but a patient's undergone a massive trauma and you're worried that they've got a big thoracic or abdominal bleed, sometimes a damage limitation approach is ideal. So this is very much where we are going to get in and get out. So we are going to obviously always count your swabs, that goes without saying. I count my swabs for every single procedure I do, so whether that's a castration versus removing an adrenal tumour, everything gets counted before and afterwards. It's part of an automatic process I'm in, and that way hopefully I don't forget to do it. So that's something again that I would really try to get everybody into doing. So for patients with a massive abdominal bleed, if you are to count your swabs, pack the abdomen with your, if pack your abdomen with laparotomy swabs, if you can't easily see the bleeding problem and you can't easily and quickly resolve it, the idea is you're going to leave these swabs in the patient, suture the abdomen. You're actually going to recover the patient, so that bit of surgical intervention is going to be less than an hour. You're then going to spend time stabilizing the patient, concentrating on your fluid resuscitation, etc., analgesia. And then a day or so later, you're going to perform a second surgery to look at the definitively sorting the problem out. So it's a very much damage limitation approach, get in, get out, and is appropriate in some situations. So do remember that. Vasoconstrictors are very useful for reducing blood flow, and this very much pertains to usually areas of the body that are jolly difficult to, you know, we can't apply pressure if a dog's got epistaxis. So if we are able to infuse adrenaline or epinephrine via some soaked swabs into the nose, for instance, and pack the nose, that can be really very useful indeed. So just be a little bit watchful. We do need to dilute these products. There's very little written conclusively on exactly how much to dilute, but I put this onto the webinar today, so a 1 in 1,000 dilution will hopefully give you the desired effects, but will hopefully reduce any cardiovascular effects from any systemic absorption that we might have. Temporary ligations are also worth considering. So if we're going to preempt, for instance, that we're doing quite invasive surgery in the mouth, so for instance a mandibulectomy, partial maxillectomy, etc. This is a neck of a very large boxer, and this is his carotid artery that you can see in front of you on the screen here, so very, very deep down. But if this can be temporarily occluded, then for sure it's going to help the blood loss during the surgery. And again, a number of textbooks will detail the different arteries that can be temporarily ligated with the use of a Rummel tourniquet type effect, or indeed a proper little vascular clamp. This is a vascular clamp that's gone on here. But the Rommel tourniquet is a very easy to use technique. So this is where we have our blood vessel. We're going to use a little bit of umbilical tape to go around the vessel, threaded through some very soft, and I usually use a section of a giving set, but it's got to be soft. We don't want a hard, spiky bit of plastic pushing into the blood vessel at the bottom here. And then if we put our forceps across the top, we can snick that down onto the vessel and give a temporary occlusion there. So Rommel tourniquet is very useful for when we want temporary ligations on vessels. Tourniquets are also more commonly used on limbs. It's not necessarily without complications. So I think I know whenever I dare to put a limb tourniquet on, I'm always very mindful of how long the tourniquet has been on for. But it's equally a very useful technique. So for those of us doing a lot of work around the lower limb, and so it enables us to see what we're doing more effectively, and therefore the surgery is more efficient and quicker. Limb tourniquets are very useful. So to apply a good limb tourniquet, the limb should be hung a little bit to start with, so that the blood is coming from the distal end to the proximal end of the limb, and then the tourniquet is applied distal to proximal. And wherever possible, you're just going to apply the tourniquet for the shortest time possible. There's not, again, a lot written and documented as to the exact guidelines for the maximum amount of time a tourniquet can be applied. However, I think if you keep this in mind, 1.5 to 2 hours maximum, that should be a good thing to remember, but clearly the shortest time possible would be the way to go. But tourniquets are going to slow the flow and reduce the blood flow. Curved mosquito hemostats or straight mosquito hemostats can be very useful. I tend to use curved mosquito hemostats. This is a dog having a non-marginal intent resection of a soft tissue sarcoma. And these little hemostats will stop the blood flow there, keep them on for 4 or 5 minutes, and it's unlikely then that I need to even use the diathermy on those vessels. Ligatures are something we use every single day, and I'm going to mention these in the context really also of thinking about bitch space. So this is, as you can probably see and envisage, this is a very young dog that's, well, I say young, she was actually 2 or 3 years old. She has got some mature fats at present as well there, but she has got a very beautifully displayed ovarian pedicle here, and this is the left ovary, so again it can be exteriorized quite nicely. However, and I'm sure everyone is out there sat there thinking, I wish all the bitch spays looked like that, and they don't, do they? So we're often dealing with very big dogs, mature dogs, very, very deep-seated ovarian pedicles that we've got to try and access. We've got to fight against the abdominal wall, fight against all the rest of the viscera that's trying to get in on the act, and we've got to tie a secure ligature. It is definitely one of the, I think, the hardest things that we, most difficult things that we have to do as veterinarians, and this is far from a routine procedure. So I put this down because by now I know many of you will have developed your perfect technique for doing this, and I think very much you have to do what you feel most comfortable with. But I just wanted to highlight to you that the most important thing is the first throw that you are going to put down around this pedicle has got to be the throw that is the least, the most resistance to slippage. And there was an interesting paper which is documented at the end of the webinar that looked at different types of knots and throws. It was in an in vitro study, so not in the live dog, but the models mimicked dogs that were over 25 kilograms with a quite fatty vascular pedicle. And they looked at the square knot, the surgeon's knot, the slip knot, and the modified transfixation knot, and the single, double, the other side knot. And both the, well, all three, the slip knot, the modified transfixation, where we're coming partly through the vessel and then tying on the other side, and the single and the double other sided knot, bit of a mouthful, all of those three completely outperformed the square and the surgeon's knot, and all of them had a far greater resistance to slippage of that first throw going down, and that was even without the slip knot being converted to a square knot at the very end, so it was just going down as a slip and staying there and then being secured by two throws to make then a square knot on top of the slip knot. So I just mentioned this because it's always worth just reviewing your technique from time to time and just seeing if there's any better way you can do something. So if those of you out there are having a bit of a run of not such good knot tying and some difficult deep abdominal fatty patients, it just might be worth rethinking about the way you tie your knots. But always, as with any surgical technique, it's practice, and practicing of knot throwing when you're not dealing with the patient is a very good thing to do. So by the time you're not throwing with the actual live patient, then you're pretty good and efficient at tying those knots. I want to mention vascular clips. So if we're in a situation, again, where we think this is going to be a very vascular surgery, for instance, a thyroid mass or removal of a spleen, then vascular clips are wonderful things to use, and they are now far more available than they used to be. So the clips I use are from a company called MediPlus, purely because that's some years ago, and that's the company we could get them from. But nowadays, both Ethicon via Vet Instrumentation and the Wet Horizon clips, which are available through Vet Direct now in the past year, are absolutely as the same as my MediPlus clips, and these are clips that are going to stay in the patient. They're not going to be removed. The applicators can be re-sterilized, so it's only then the cartridges that you're purchasing. So as you can see, it's not an expensive way to gain excellent hemostasis. So one thing to point out is when the clips are being applied around the vessel, as you're closing them between the jaws of the applicator here, the tips must touch together, and then the clip is flattened out completely. If you've got tissue sitting, if you've got tissue sitting between the tips of the clip, then the clip is not secure and could eventually just slip right off again. So you must have the tips touching, i.e. the tissue must be within the clip here for that clip to be secure. It must not override and spill out of the clip. So that's just important to remember. The clips come in different sizes, and it's just a case of getting a few different sizes and a few different applicator sizes to be able to fit the clips. So the applicators collect the clip, and then, as you can see here, this is a splenectomy being performed, and I'm putting on here some clips over the hilar vessels, and it's nice and accurate, nice and quick, a very nice blood-free surgery. But these clips can obviously be used if we've got that situation of we've got a bleeder in the abdomen. This could be your definitive way of potentially sorting that bleeder out. And it's nice because you're putting them in like you would use a hemostat. So often, in cases that are bleeding, you get your hemostat on, you think, great, I've got my hemostat on, but I can't leave my hemostat in this abdomen. What am I now going to do? And so the use of the clips might well be an option, providing the clip tips touch each other and you're not just putting it on, like a paper clip. So this is just some examples. This is a very vascular adrenal tumour. This is a very big thyroid mass that I saw in a cat a few months ago. And again, these clips are absolutely ideal for these types of surgery. Other forms of stapling devices that can aid us with hemostasis and surgical bleeding or preventing of the surgical bleeding, we've got the ligating dividing stapler. So this is CO2 powered. Again, these are very useful for splenectomies specifically, although I would say, is it trustworthy on the actual splenic artery and vein? My personal experience, I would say, no, it isn't. It's also quite a bulky device, as you can see from the picture here. You've got to get it around the hilar vessels in order to then apply the staple. It staples, it cuts between in one fell swoop. So it's a costly device to purchase. This is roughly the cost price without it going out to the client, and you can only use it once. You can't re-sterilize it unless you've got perhaps an ethylene oxide type facility. So to me, this is something I very rarely use nowadays. I much prefer to use my surgical clips. The thoracoabdominal stapler is a very useful device. This enables us to lay in staggered rows of staples when it's fired. So some devices will lay in three rows of staggered staples, and others it will just be two rows. So these are very useful for lung or liver lobectomy, maybe partial splenectomy, if we ever get those cases. Occasionally we do. Occasionally we might get spleens that are, you know, traumatized, and we can preserve half the spleen. Again, they're expensive devices to use, although nowadays we can refill, refill the cartridge refills are available, and again, the actual devices, the actual applicators can be sterilized with ethylene oxide. So they've got their place. Again, whenever I use one of these devices, I don't use them every week. So whenever I use them, I get out the instructions. I just run through it the day before so I know exactly which buttons I'm pressing in which order, so that I hopefully get the results I want. So that's just a close-up there of a TA. This was a TA60. And again, you can just see we've got the two indentations there, and the tissue again has got to fit within this area. It mustn't come beyond the pin. Anything beyond the pin is not going to be stapled. Other methods where we can limit surgical bleeding is the use of diathermy and cautery. And as I was saying earlier, I think very much this is something that really there's no excuse nowadays. These machines are not that prohibitive in cost. The machine I use is around about £1,000. I've had it for years. It might be that my handpieces from time to time here, this is a bipolar handpiece, need replacing, but they are small units and are extremely useful for many types of surgical approaches and surgery that you will perform on a day-to-day basis. So this is using radio frequency, so electrical current, to generate heat. So I'm a bipolar user, so the electrical current is running between the two tips here, so it's a very precise way of cauterizing blood vessels. The monopolar is where you have just one blade, and you're directly, and that electrical current is touching a set of forceps, which is touching the vessel, but the electrical current is going through the patient. So that is where absolutely you need a grounding plate. Without a grounding plate, the patient will get burn injuries. So there's no need for a patient to get thermal burn related injuries to the use of diathermy, but you just need to be very vigilant with your application of the grounding plate if you're using monopolar diathermy. Other electrothermal vessel sealing devices are available, and again, they're becoming that we're using these a little bit more and more. They are quite a bit more expensive, although again, I think year on year they come down a little bit in price. So these are our machines known as the LigaSure and the Surge RX. They still operate as bipolar, but it's bipolar and pressure at the same time. They denature collagen. And the fantastic thing about these is they can now tackle vessels that are a little bit wider. So unlike our mycautery unit, which perhaps can only tackle vessels sort of 2 millimetres at most, we're now looking at vessels 7 millimetres or less that these devices are capable of sealing. So very, very capable in their use. The Ethicon device, the Surge RX, can be used, as with the LigaSure, it can be used as part of a laparoscopic procedure or as part of open surgery. And this machine in particular can deliver heat of up to 100 degrees C, but it can limit it to a thermal spread of 1 millimetre. So it's a very, very accurate delivery indeed. Another one you may have heard of, again, is the Harmonic Scalpel. Similar, but it just delivers, the heat is induced by ultrasonic vibrations. And again, it's again a nice machine to use, both as open or closed surgery. How else can we limit surgical bleeding? There are a huge number of topical products available nowadays. I guess the ones that I use most are the mechanical hemostatic agents. So I will use, as in this picture here, this from time to time, I will use a bit of bone wax. Bone wax is made from beeswax, it will stay in the patient, so it's not something that's going to dissolve, etc. But it's very, very useful where you've got bleeding coming from the foramens of the maxilla or the mandible, or perhaps even as a rescue during ear surgery. It can be an absolutely life-saving little bit of kit is to have a bit of bone wax available. So bone wax is one. I use a bovine derived collagen. I do use Lyostipt, and it's very useful for putting in and around livers where you've done a liver biopsy. This isn't a liver biopsy. This would be a huge biopsy site. This is a packed it into a gallbladder resection site there. But the use in for liver biopsies, you can cut small sections out of the Lyostipt and then put it into the liver, the punch biopsy area where you've taken the section of liver from. With collagen, there are also collagens that come impregnated with gentamicin. I just draw this to your attention for if ever you have a situation where it's not so much, I guess, the bleeding you are terribly worried about, but you've got an ongoing resistant deep-seated infections, then the use of something like Collatamp can be really quite helpful. But there are a huge number of topical products that are available and that are excellent. And I think, again, it's more a case of finding the ones that you prefer to use. I will sometimes use one called Hemoblock as well. There's one called Surgicel that Ethicon produce, and they're all extremely useful for that topical application. And most of these are going to dissolve in time. You're not taking them back out of the patient. They're very much you're using them, you're leaving them in the patients. If we have a situation whereby we have got a huge amount of blood loss during surgery, we may need to consider then what are we going to do. Blood products and the volumes of blood products that we can get our hands on are often limited. So if we have a situation where And probably a classic is whereby a bitch has been neutered, and she has a slow recovery, and she comes in the next day and she's really quite flat, etc. And you realise, you think, oh my golly, we've got a hemoabdomen. It's quite, there's no harm in considering, should you actually transfuse that blood that you're looking at in the abdomen back into the circulatory system of that patient, so i.e. autotransfusion. And there again, I've made a note at the end of the webinar of a relatively recent paper on a very quick and easy way of doing that, and this is where the patient's blood is going to be collected in 60ml catheter tip type syringes. So they're the syringes that are conical ended, and you're going to suction that blood out of the abdomen and hand it to an assistant. The assistant is then going to take another 60ml syringe with a normal Luerlock syringe end, put it into the catheter tip conical end, and suck the blood into that syringe. By then fitting a blood filter onto the end of that ordinary syringe, you can then connect your giving set and actually rapidly inject it intravenously back into your patient. So that is classed as a, you know, it's a massive transfusion, but it really can be quite successful in those very, you know, emergency situations where you've got quite often big dogs with massive hemoabdomen, and there is no way you're going to be able to just suddenly miraculously get a blood product to transfuse in the more normal fashion. So it's important to say, obviously, the blood needs to be non-contaminated. So if for any reason you think you've got, a disruption of a viscera as well as the blood, then clearly you're not going to start auto-transfusing. And the other important thing is you don't need to have anticoagulant within these syringes that you're using. So have a look at the reference at the end of the webinar. It's a useful one for those situations that crop up every now and again. I also wanted to just briefly mention the use of antifibrinolytic agents in human medicine, particularly in obstetric units and gynae units, maternity wards, whereby perhaps postpartum women will experience a huge amount of blood loss. It's very common that tranexamic acid is given as a part of a preventative to inhibit fibrinolysis, and certainly if a patient is exhibiting bleeding, it's given either intravenously or in tablet form. It lasts for about 24 hours, it's excreted in the urine. It's certainly not effective though for our dogs with a coagulopathy. If a dog's got a known coagulopathy, you don't start giving an antifibrinolytic agent, that wouldn't work. But I draw it to your attention because certainly our greyhounds, our retired greyhounds that make such wonderful pets, they certainly have they are a little bit prone to developing a delayed onset of hemorrhage 36 to 48 hours after an ovariohysterectomy. Those dogs have normal platelet plug formation, so their buccal mucosal bleeding time is normal, their PT and APTT values are normal, so it's not that they have a coagulopathy, but we think that they actually though may have a problem with their ability, their stability of their blood clot that forms. So it forms, but it doesn't stay stable for as long as it should, so it starts to dissolve before the actual vessel has properly sealed. So it's, again, I've put some references at the end of the webinar because I knew today I wouldn't have time to go through all the details with you on those papers, but it makes for some interesting reading. And for those of us that do a lot of greyhound work and neutering of greyhounds specifically, where we're doing bigger abdominal procedures with them, obviously, first and foremost, using good hemostatic techniques is paramount. So using your diathermy, using your hemostats, making an incision that's of length where you can see what you're doing so your ligatures are accurate is absolutely key, but it also might be worth just considering, you know, having a prescription collected for these products so that you can use them. Obviously, they're off license for our veterinary patients, but you can use them for those patients whereby this is a problem. So to finish with, I thought I'd just look at the bleeding bitch spay with you. But again, a lot of what I'm going to say here pertains to, you know, if we've got a bleeder, don't panic. What are we going to do about it? So although I've entitled it the bleeding bitch spay, it really pertains to any sort of abdominal bleeding situation. So length of incision. I know I've mentioned this briefly already today, but you have to have an incision that's long enough in order for you to retract widely enough to see either side of the abdomen. So if we're looking at the bitch spay specifically, we're looking at the right and the left paravertebral gutter is where our ovarian pedicle, our bleeding pedicle, will be sitting. Now, it's not always the ovarian pedicle that's bleeding. Sometimes it can be from the cervix. But you do need to say, just to get this idea into our heads, that you do need a long incision to see what's going on. This is an image from a dog that's having a surgery to do with the cranial abdomen. Obviously, I'm not suggesting necessarily you're going to start incising right up to the xiphoid, up to the xiphoid here, but it's just to get that point across. Something, again, that we were perhaps taught at veterinary college, although again, when I think back, I don't think it was something that was really I was made very aware of. It's something I'm more aware of as time has gone on. But in order to see those paravertebral gutters, if we pick up our duodenum and we move it to the left, that will expose the right paravertebral gutter where the ovarian pedicle will be sitting, and equally with the colon. If we pick up our colon and we move that then to the right, we get the left side. And so in our paravertebral gutters, we have, suddenly lots of little bits of anatomy that we don't normally see. So we've got our kidney, our adrenal, our vena cava, our portal veins, our ureters, the ovary, etc. So it's a simple technique to use. So wherever you have got a bleeding bitch spay, do consider the duodenal maneuver. So this is our duodenum. This is in a cat, so everything's a bit superficial on this image. But just to get the idea across, so this duodenum is being gently picked up, moved towards the left-hand side, and all of a sudden we can see the kidney popping up there, we can see the renal vein, etc. In our view. And then if we, same thing with the colon, if we gently hold the colon and move it to the right, again we can start to see the anatomy and viscera down in the paravertebral gutter there. So it's very, very useful and enables you to see the area that's likely to be a problem. So wherever we've got an abdominal bleeder, you're prepared. You've got everything counted out. If you need to call for new swabs, you're going to count those swabs out again. You're going to do, if appropriate, your duodenal or colonic manoeuvres, so the D or C manoeuvres. You're going to pack in your swabs. So there's nothing like packing in swabs in order to see what you're doing. So get your swabs packed into that abdomen. And then you're going to retract. Now that retraction might be a self-retaining retraction, or it might be that you get a colleague to scrub in and get their hands in. So getting a pair of hands into the abdomen with the swabs behind the fingers, suddenly you'll be able to see a lot more. You're then going to clamp your bleeder. And now you've got thinking time. What are you going to do? You're going to ligate it again? Are you going to clip it? But you've now regained control. You're then going to check the result. Is it good enough? Have you got a dry surgical field? And importantly, we're going to recount your swabs again, because we don't want to leave a swab in. Okay, so I'm going to end the webinar there. I hope it's been useful to you in some in some way, just to pick up again on preempting. So good surgical performance, we're preempting things. Have we got a patient that is likely to bleed? Are we doing a procedure that's likely to cause bleeding whereby we're going to need extra support products? Have we got the right surgical equipment that if we do need to do lots of ligations and clips, we've got everything at the ready? So preparation is the absolute foundation to a good and careful and safe surgical performance for our patients. And that way, good, accurate, meticulous hemostasis forms a huge part of that performance. So I hope today you've picked up some little tips and tricks, and I'll leave you now with that. There's a couple of articles I've popped down at the end, which just may be of interest to you in relation to the webinar today. Thank you very much for your time.
On behalf of Webinar Club, I'd like to thank Catherine for a great presentation today. The recording and the certificate for this webinar will be available in the next few days in the members area of Webinar Club. Thank you all for attending. That's the end of the webinar.